And now it's time for the Earth First Update. All the environmental news you can use. Uncle Dennis here in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz on September 3rd. And I do want to ask you to have a pencil and paper handy, because you never know when there's something out there that you want to take a note about. A web page, email address, telephone number, address, something, time, a place you want to be. You need to write it down. That way you'll remember to do it later. At least that's the way I am. Anyway, coming up on the 24th through the 27th of September in North Carolina is the Southeast U.S. Genetically Engineered Trees Action Camp. We've been telling you about this for a few weeks. Participation is free, room and board provided, but space is limited, and the application deadline is coming up. That application should go to, you want to go to the webpage, globaljusticeecology.org/apply-action-camp. Once again, globaljusticeecology.org/apply-action-camp. The South is ground zero for genetically engineered trees, and folks need to come together to save the native forests. These folks have been collaborating with activists and groups all across the South against GE trees. You'll be given a direct overview of the current state of genetically engineered tree industry with a focus on the U.S. South. You'll get training in organizing, direct action, blockades, your rights as protesters, how to use media and art in protest, and lots of other things. What they're going to do is train you for immediate and direct use of those skills and knowledge in protests and organizing against genetically engineered trees. Once again, September 24th through the 27th in North Carolina. To sign up, go to globaljusticeecology.org/apply-action-camp. And we'll probably read that one again next week if you missed it. And voting is now open for the first annual People, Land, Truth Awards in this notice from Intercontinental Cry. They have officially launched their People, Land, Truth Awards, an annual awards program that recognizes excellence in the field of investigative journalism. We are very excited to honor and recognize those among us who've worked tirelessly to educate us and keep us informed about some of the most pressing issues of our time, said John Shertow, Intercontinental Cry's editor-in-chief. Journalists are the unsung heroes of the information age, Shertow continued. While many of us work in boardrooms or in the comfort of our own homes, journalists are constantly heading out to the front lines of the world, risking incarceration, kidnapping, deportation, torture, and even their lives in order to tell us what's happening around us. They are the eyes and ears of the world. The People, Land, Truth Awards is our way of saying thanks for all the crucial work that journalists do, and especially journalists at Intercontinental Cry who do it free of charge, not to mention Uncle Dennis. And now until October 1st, the public is encouraged to offer some thanks of their own by voting for their favorite articles in the PLTA Awards. Once the voting closes in 4 weeks, Intercontinental Cry's editorial board will begin to prepare the winning group of articles for the next issue of People, Land, Truth magazine published by Daykeeper Press. Each winning author will also receive a copy of all magazines that IC has published, and their articles will be promoted on the website for a full year. To take part in the PLTA Awards, visit intercontinentalcry.org/PLT awards. Once again, that's intercontinentalcry.org/PLT awards. And get on that. We'll read that one again. The Boulder White Clouds Wilderness Bill has been signed. President Obama signed the bill designating 275,000 acres of wilderness in Idaho, east of the existing Sawtooth Wilderness. The campaign for protecting the Boulder White Cloud area has been going on for some 15 years, but the final congressional passage seems to have been propelled by fears that President Obama might designate a national monument in the area. That monument, at least as it was discussed, would have protected a much larger area, approximately 571,000 acres. The designated wilderness was split into three separate areas, separated by road corridors, which dilutes their wilderness character considerably. And the bill also released 155,000 acres of wilderness study areas and land recommended for wilderness by the Forest Service. And released means that it can now be logged, roaded, and set up for all kinds of destruction. So while it is nice to see that Congress is actually doing something productive, the results are somewhat of a disappointment, too. So anyway, that's the news. Boulder White Clouds Wilderness has been designated in Idaho. If you want more information about all wilderness in the western United States, go to caluwild.org. That's caluwild.org. And the United States' tallest mountain has been restored to its original indigenous name. This article was originally published in Nationalia, and it was republished at Intercontinental Cry and Earth First Radio News under a Creative Commons license. The highest mountain in the United States and in North America has recovered its original indigenous name, Mount Denali, for official purposes after a decades-long dispute. The White House signed the decision last week, which announced, coinciding with a visit by President Barack Obama to Alaska, the U.S. state where the summit is found. The name Denali has its origins in the language of the Koyukon people who inhabit the area north of the summit. In the Koyukon language, Denali means the tall one. The 6,168-meter-high mountain, roughly 20,000 feet, was officially known until now at the federal level as Mount McKinley in honor of an American president who was assassinated in 1901. The state of Alaska, through its Board of Geographical Names, had restored Denali as the peak's official name in 1975, but only in Alaska. At the federal level, McKinley denomination remained in force, although the Alaskan legislature had asked the federal authorities to also adopt Denali as the summit's official name. The Obama administration has now decided to rename it in recognition of the traditions of Alaskan natives and the strong support of the people of Alaska, according to Interior Secretary Sally Jewell. In 2010, a census revealed that 15% of Alaskans belong to one of the state's native peoples. In addition to this symbolic recognition, Obama is expected to announce later in the week new measures to help Alaskan natives. I believe he did that. According to this government report, 18% of Alaskan natives are living below the poverty line in 2009. The share among the whites, however, was only 5.5%. Natives are also the group with lower household income and less percentage of high school and college graduates. And a judge has sided with tribal scientists preventing a Klamath River fish kill in this story from Intercontinental Cry. A federal judge on August 27th denied a request by the San Luis Delta Mendota Water Authority and Westlands Water District for a temporary restraining order and preliminary injunction against the higher supplemental flows from Trinity Reservoir being released to stop a fish kill on the lower Klamath River. The releases that the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation began last week, resulting from requests by the Hoopa Valley and Yurok Tribe fishery scientists to release Trinity water to stop a fish kill like the one that killed up to 78,000 adult salmon in September of 2002, will continue. The two tribes, the Pacific Coast Federation of Fishermen's Associations and the Institute of Fisheries Resources, were interveners for the defendant, Interior Secretary Sally Jewell, and the U.S. Department of Interior in the litigation. In his decision, U.S. District Court Judge Lawrence O'Neill said, the court concludes that there is no clear showing of likelihood of success on the merits. Even if plaintiffs were likely to succeed on the merits, at least one of their claims against reclamation in conjunction with the 2015 flow augmentation releases, the balance of harms does not warrant an injunction at this time. The potential harm to the plaintiffs from the potential but far from certain loss of added water supply in 2015 or 2016 does not outweigh the potentially catastrophic damage that more likely than not will occur to this year's salmon runs in the absence of the 2015 flow augmentation releases, ruled the judge. This denial of the request by corporate agribusiness interests to halt badly needed flows for the Lower Klamath River is a big victory for the Hoopa Valley Tribe, the Yurok Tribe, and fishing groups. Both this year and last, tribal activists held protests demanding the release of Trinity River water to stop fish kills. I'm very pleased with the decision in terms of the protection of fish and the preventative flows being released, said Mike Orcutt, fisheries director of the Hoopa Valley Tribe, Hobble County's annual right to 50,000 acre-feet of water from Trinity Reservoir was a key part in the court's decision and reasoning. We're glad that the court interpreted that use of that water as we have advocated for years for beneficial uses, including protecting fish. We have never given up on this source of water since 2003, and we have worked on securing that water for Humboldt County and downstream users. The most important thing is that it's good for fish, Troy Fletcher, executive director of the Yurok Tribe, told Associated Press. It's too many years that we have had to worry about our fish, and we need to land on some long-term solutions that increase the health of the Klamath River. In this fourth year of severe drought, the conditions on the river call for us to take extraordinary measures to reduce the potential for a large-scale fish die-off, said Mid-Pacific Regional Director David Murillo. The Bureau of Reclamation last week announced it would release additional water from the Trinity Reservoir for Lower Klamath River to help protect returning adult fall run Chinook salmon from a disease outbreak and mortality. Supplemental flows from Lewiston Dam on the Trinity River began on Friday, August 21st, and will extend into late September. Releases from Lewiston Dam were adjusted to target 2,800 cubic feet per second in the Lower Klamath River starting last week. Flows from Lewiston could be raised as high as 3,500 cubic feet per second for up to 5 days if real-time monitoring information suggests a need for additional supplemental flows as an emergency response. Dan Nelson, executive director of the San Luis and Delta Mendota Water Authority, explained the reasoning behind the lawsuit that they launched after Reclamation announced the flow releases. As our state is faced with a water supply crisis affecting every sector of people, businesses, and communities, an action like this is unthinkable. This will cause irreparable harm to drought-stricken communities already facing water restrictions, said Nelson in a press release. However, Judge O'Neill disagreed. There will be those who credit the court for this decision and those who will discredit the court for this decision. Let it be understood by both camps that the court is obliged to follow the law as it is. That has occurred regardless of the absence or presence of the popularity of the ruling, Judge O'Neill concluded. Bald and golden eagles are victorious. The court has invalidated a 30-year eagle take rule. The U.S. District Court, Northern District of California in San Jose, has ruled that the Department of Interior violated federal laws when it created a final regulation allowing wind energy and other companies to obtain 30-year permits to kill protected bald and golden eagles without prosecution by the federal government. The recent court decision invalidates that rule. American Bird Conservancy, a plaintiff in the lawsuit, hailed the decision. We are pleased that the courts agreed with us that improper shortcuts were taken in the development of this rule, said Dr. Michael Hutchins, director of ABC's BirdSmart Wind Energy Program. The court found that important laws meant to protect our nation's wildlife were not properly followed by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, putting bald and golden eagles at greater risk. The court wrote, Substantial questions are raised as to whether the final 30-year rule may have a significant adverse effect on bald and golden eagle populations. In particular, the court cited a lack of compliance with the National Environmental Policy Act. We're ready to work with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to conduct the required NEPA analysis and formulate a better system to protect eagles from poorly sited wind energy projects, said Hutchins. We must come up with a better system to assess the potential risks to birds and bats prior to a project siting and construction, and to track and mitigate project impacts post-construction. The previous Eagle Take Rule, adopted in 2009, provided for a maximum duration of 5 years for each permit to kill eagles. A key part of the court's ruling held that Fish and Wildlife Service has failed to show an adequate basis for the record for deciding not to prepare an environmental impact statement, much less an environmental assessment, prior to increasing the maximum duration for programmatic Eagle Take permits by sixfold. While promoting renewable energy projects may well be a worthy goal, the ruling continued, it is no substitute for the agency's obligations to comply with NEPA and to conduct a studied review in response to concerns about the environmental implications of major agency decisions. Accordingly, the court found the Fish and Wildlife Service violated NEPA's procedural requirements and that the final 30-year rule must therefore be set aside and remanded back to the Fish and Wildlife Service for further consideration. And that probably means that the 5-year permits have expired. Don't know what they're going to do about that. The court cited concerns that had been raised by Fish and Wildlife staff during the development of the 30-year Eagle Rule, stating the record in the case bolsters the court's conclusion, as Fish and Wildlife Service's failure to adequately address concern raised by its experts is cause for the court to find a NEPA violation. The American Bird Conservancy filed a lawsuit on June 19th of 2014 in federal court against the Department of Interior, alleging multiple violations of federal law in connection with the December 9th, 2013 rulemaking. ABC contended that the decision violated the National Environmental Policy Act, the Bald and Golden Eagle Protection Act, and other statutes. ABC believes that wind energy and other renewable energy sources can be encouraged without putting bald and golden eagles and other protected wildlife at risk. Proper siting of turbines is critical. A new ABC-funded research has revealed that more than 30,000 wind turbines have been installed in areas critical to the survival of federally protected birds in the United States, and that more than 50,000 additional turbines are planned for construction in similar areas. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is one of the American Bird Conservancy's most important partners, said ABC President George Fenwick. We collaborate frequently, share many goals, and have enjoyed many successes together. However, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is currently encountering unprecedented financial constraints that lead to shortcuts and poor decisions. We hope that this court decision shines a light on the need for the service to be fully empowered to do the job it was mandated to do. Our nation's wildlife and the agency appointed to protect it deserve nothing less. The American Birds Conservancy is the Western Hemisphere's bird conservation specialist, the only organization with a single and steadfast commitment to achieving conservation results for native birds and their habitats throughout the Americas. With a focus on efficiency and working in partnership, we take on the toughest problems facing birds today, innovating and building on sound science to halt extinctions, protect habitats, eliminate threats, and build capacity for bird conservation. And you can find out more about the American Bird Conservancy and what they do at www.abcbirds.org. That's abcbirds.org. And here's an update on the Recapture Canyon off-highway vehicle ride case that we told you about a year ago. Controversy continues to swirl following the conviction of San Juan County Commissioner Phil Lyman for trespass after leading an all-terrain vehicle ride up a closed route in Recapture Canyon outside Blanding, Utah last year. Late last week, the federal judge who presided over the trial withdrew from the case before sentencing after the defense objected to the judge's friendship with one of the lawyers for the defendant and also to a letter that urged a strict sentence. The Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance is not a party to the case since it's a criminal matter, but it had argued prosecution of Lyman and others immediately, urged prosecution of Lyman and others immediately after the protest ride. The judge decided that it was best to recuse himself in order to avoid even the appearance of a conflict of interest. Lyman's defense also filed a motion asking for a new trial, claiming that the Bureau of Land Management had withheld a map from evidence which showed Recapture Canyon as a legitimate RS-2477 route. And we'll keep you posted as things develop further, and you can find out more information at www.caluwild.org. That's CALUWILD.org. And Denmark has ordered the seizure of the San Simon small boat as Faroese consultant challenges the grind law. Authorities in the Shetland Islands, Scotland, have seized a small boat of the Sea Shepherd ship San Simon. The seizure was enacted at the request of Denmark in response to a letter of request issued by the chief of police of the Faroe Islands on August 22nd. The warrant for the seizure was presented to the captain and ship manager of the San Simon, which was in the Shetland Islands to refuel. In the warrant, authorities claim there were reasonable grounds for suspecting that an offense had been committed under the law of Denmark. It is understood that the confiscation relates to the small boat's involvement in the defense of 61 pilot whales at a grindrap on the killing beach of Sandavagur in the Faroe Islands on August 12th. The small boat is now in police custody in the Shetland Islands. Sea Shepherd is seeking further legal advice on the matter. Chief Executive Officer of Sea Shepherd Global, Captain Alex Cornelissen, stated, "On one hand, the government of Denmark refuses to abide by the European Union laws that protect cetaceans. On the other hand, Denmark is abusing its EU position and resources to try and silence Sea Shepherd's opposition to the Grindrap. Denmark's ongoing support of the slaughter of pilot whales in the Faroe Islands is a national shame." The seizure of the small boat comes in the wake of a legal challenge against the Faroe Islands Pilot Whaling Act. The Faroese legal consultant, former police officer and advisor in issues regarding safety, security, defense, and emergency preparedness, Henrik Wijonsen, has filed charges against Faroe Islands Ministry of Fisheries and Maritime Affairs, challenging the legality of the Grind Law. In a statement on August 20th, Johnson said that the Grind Law is invalid because Faroese Parliament does not have the legislative authority to implement new laws in relation to police activity, which concerns action against persons and objects. Johnson believes that if the Pilot Whaling Act is declared invalid, it may have a great impact on the cases already brought against Sea Shepherd and may also have implications for the political relationship between the Faroe Islands and Denmark. The Pilot Whaling Act has been used as the basis for the arrests of 14 Sea Shepherd volunteers in the Faroe Islands this year, five of whom have already been deported. The verdict in the case against another five Sea Shepherd volunteers who have been charged with violating the Grind Law was to be handed down yesterday in a Danish court on the Faroe Islands. The volunteers, Rudy de Kivit of the Netherlands, Laurie Thompson of the United Kingdom, Tobias Bohm of Germany, Alice Bowden of Italy, and Francis Holtman of the United States are charged with disrupting the same slaughter at Sandavagrun August 12th. The slaughter of cetaceans is outlawed throughout the European Union, including Denmark, in accordance with Appendix 2 on the Convention of Conservation of European Wildlife and Natural Habitats, the Berne Convention. However, in the Faroe Islands, the slaughter of pilot whales and other small cetaceans continues with the assistance of the Danish police and navy, and with the blessing of the Danish government. This year alone, 490 pilot whales have been slaughtered in the Faroe Islands with Denmark's backing. Sea Shepherd has both the legal right and the moral obligation to protect pilot whales that pass through the Faroe Islands, and that is exactly what we will continue to do, said Captain Cornelissen. Sea Shepherd has been leading opposition to the Grindrap since the early 1980s and is currently in the Faroe Islands for the organization's sixth pilot whale defense campaign, Operation Sleipnir Grindini. And if you'd like more information about that go to www.cshepherd.org.au. That's www.cshepherd.org.au. And Florida officials proposed a bear hunt limit of 320 kills in this story, edited by David Adams and Lisa Lambert, World Environment News, Thomson Reuters. Florida would allow hunters to kill up to a total of 320 bears in October during the state's first bear hunt season in 20 years, according to a recommendation from the state's wildlife agency presented at a public hearing on Wednesday. The bear hunt was approved in June by the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission over strenuous opposition from animal rights and conservation groups. About 50 people signed up to speak to the commission about the quota at a public hearing, which began late in the afternoon in Fort Lauderdale prior to the vote. The hunt is scheduled from October 24th through the 30th, although it will be stopped if the quota is reached early. The commission initially suggested the hunt would help reduce bear-human conflicts in parts of the state where subdivisions have been built in traditional bear habitat. Four people have been seriously injured by bears in the past 2 years, according to the state's bear expert, Thomas Eason. Eason said studies show those conflicts could virtually end if residents did a better job of containing garbage and food waste, which draws bears into their neighborhoods. Eason said the agency is encouraging municipalities to require people who live in bear country to use bear-proof garbage cans. Duh. The hunt rules allow firearms and bows and arrows to be used, but no unleashed dogs or bait. The bag limit is one bear per hunter. And unfortunately, that's all the time we have for the Earth First Update this week. The Earth First Update is presented every Thursday evening at 9 o'clock right here on Free Radio Santa Cruz 101.3 FM. And you can also hear us live streaming at www.freakradio.org. We also broadcast a rebroadcast of this show tomorrow afternoon at 3 p.m. right here on 101.3 FM and www.freakradio.org. If you happen to live in the Moscow, Idaho area, you can listen to a rebroadcast of this show on 90.3 FM KRFP at 9:30 p.m. on Monday nights. Or you could go to radioforall.net, and there you can listen online or download this or previous Earth First updates. Once again, that webpage is radio4all.net, and please do support all of these radio stations and the Radio for All Net archive so that these shows can continue to be shared and broadcast at other stations. I'm sure there are other people broadcasting the Earth First Update. They just haven't let me know that they were doing so. The Earth First Update is produced in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz. I want to thank you for listening. The Earth First Update is a production of Earth First Radio. And you can support us and Free Radio Santa Cruz by going to www.freakradio.org. Well, thank you for listening, and do tune in next Thursday night at 9 o'clock for another edition of the Earth First Update.